Let's go to the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue now to NPR's David Wellna, who is at the Capitol. David, what are congressional leaders saying about those meetings today?
Both Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Speaker John Boehner put out two-sentence statements. They were very similar in saying that they were working on a bipartisan basis to get to some kind of a solution. Speaker Boehner called it a bipartisan solution, and Senator McConnell, interestingly, called it new legislation. Now, this suggests that something new might be in the works, and the word is they may be looking for something that is a shorter term increase in the debt ceiling.
David, there's been talk about some kind of deal where Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, Republican leader, is behind this idea that essentially Republicans would vote against a debt ceiling limit. The president would then veto it, and that would allow him to raise it. Does there seem to be support for that kind of idea, at least in the House?
No, in the House, there is definite opposition to that idea. There is support in the Senate on both sides of the aisle for that. But because that is a solution that does not have the corresponding spending cuts for every dollar that the debt ceiling is increased, many House Republicans say they would not vote for it. In fact, 87 of them have sent a letter to the top two Republican leaders in the House saying, do not support this and do not bring it to the floor.
David, there are some congressional Republicans who say they won't vote for a debt limit increase under any circumstances. Could you imagine a scenario where you've got a sort of a coalition of some House Republicans and House Democrats essentially putting this over the top?
Well, it would have to be something that would have something in it for both sides of the aisle. And that's really what they're looking for right now. There is a recognition that there has to be deficit reduction accompanying an increase in the debt ceiling, if only to prevent the ratings agencies from downgrading U.S. Treasuries. That's a real danger that people in both parties recognize is out there. And I think that there's a recognition now that they are dangerously close to the edge. In terms of trying to get something through the Senate, you need, if there's opposition to a piece of legislation, you need at least 120 hours of debate to get a single piece of legislation through. That really means that they have to have something on the floor of the House no later than Wednesday and get it to the Senate by Wednesday night if they're going to make the August 2nd deadline.
Wow. The clock is ticking. That's NPR's David Wellna from Capitol Hill. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here's another story of something lost and then rediscovered. In this case, ashes missing for three quarters of a century. NPR's Margot Adler brings us this postcard from Vienna.
My grandfather's ashes had been missing for 74 years. He was a famous Viennese psychoanalyst, Alfred Adler, best known for inventing the inferiority complex and for splitting with Freud in 1911 over issues of sex and power. But in 1937, he died of a heart attack while lecturing in Aberdeen, Scotland. Growing up, I never heard anyone talk about the whereabouts of Adler's remains. But some people started searching. Christine Roshi, the head of the Alfred Adler Institute in Vienna, was one of those people. Over the years, she asked,
where is the grave? And so it started the research.
But the ashes weren't in Aberdeen. Some psychotherapists teamed up with John Clifford, the honorary Austrian consul for Scotland. And then one day, they walked into a crematorium in Edinburgh, right near Clifford's office. And there was a small wooden box of ashes with the name Alfred Adler, the founder of individual psychology.
10 minutes away from me, you know, he was sleeping almost under my pillow.
Since none of Adler's four children were alive, I had to prove that I was the heir and could make the decision to take the ashes back to Vienna, where Adler was born. So here we are, 74 years after his death.
It is a very special pleasure for me to welcome you all to this memorial ceremony for Alfred Adler here.
On July 12th, I joined some 100 people at the Zentralfriedhof in Vienna, along with my 20-year-old son, Adler's only great-grandchild. It's the largest cemetery in Vienna. It's where Beethoven and Brahms and Schubert are buried. Other relatives of Alfred Adler are there, cousins from Amsterdam like Suzanne Hogendijk, who at age 15 actually hid from the Nazis for 2.5 years, just like Anne Frank, but she survived. And here she is, an 86-year-old former judge, who says this makes her feel very rooted.
I'm very glad I'm here now.
She remembers Alfred Adler when he visited her parents in Holland. She says she was irritated at the way her parents treated him like a guru and asked for advice about her education.
He advised my parents to take care that I wouldn't marry a person who was too neurotic.
The Austrian media are having a field day. I'm suddenly on the other side of the microphone, interviewed by radio, television, a newspaper, a magazine, over coffee and pastries at the Café Landmann, where Sigmund Freud used to go. Reporters repeatedly said they couldn't understand how the ashes could have been lost for so long. At the ceremony, there is a brass ensemble, flowers, and a ridiculous number of psychotherapists. I think no one kept track of the ashes because of the times. In 1937, Alfred's favorite daughter had already been arrested in the Soviet Union and was in the Gulag, where she would die. The Nazis were on the rise. The Adlers moved permanently to the U.S. in 1935. They weren't religious. I tell the interviewers, my family was more concerned with life and ideas than with ashes. Still, there's something mysterious about this 74-year journey. One speaker at the ceremony, who represented culture and science for the city of Vienna, says this is the city of psychoanalysis, but Adler's findings about the human mind belong to the whole world. Margot Adler, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
A survey in 2008 showed that close to 12% of Americans claim Irish ancestry, and at least half of our presidents have. Even President Obama has a little Irish in him. But it turns out Americans have nothing on polar bears. A new study says all living polar bears can trace their ancestry to Ireland, specifically one brown bear who lived there around 20 to 30,000 years ago during the last ice age. Beth Shapiro is an associate professor of biology at Penn State and one of the authors of the polar bear study. She joins me now from the studios of member station WPSU in State College. Beth, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
How did polar bears end up in Ireland? Because I thought there were no bears. I've been to Ireland. I have never seen a bear there.
Well, brown bears used to live in Ireland. They went extinct 8,000 or 9,000 years ago. But it was before that that these bears happened to interact with polar bears.
And you have traced all polar bears to one brown bear in Ireland.
All living polar bears.
All living
polar bears. We have to keep that in mind.
Okay.
Before these living polar bears had a common ancestor in Ireland, there were polar bears, and this is an important part of the story. So we did this by looking at the DNA sequences that we could retrieve from the bones of these bears that used to live in Ireland, as well as all across the Northern Hemisphere. See, in every cell, there are two different sources of DNA. There's the mitochondrial DNA, which you inherit from your mother.
Right.
Then there's the nuclear DNA, which is a mix of the DNA that you get from your mother and father. If we look at that mixed DNA, the nuclear DNA, for brown bears and for polar bears, and we ask when they started to diverge to become different species, we can see that that happened somewhere around 500,000 to maybe a couple of million years ago. But if we look at this mitochondrial DNA, they diverged only about 20 or 30,000 years ago. And that difference is intriguing, and it means that there's something weird going on in the history of polar bears.
So how did they actually crossbreed? I mean, presumably they're different habitats, right? Brown bears don't live on ice, and polar bears do.
Well, around the time that we think this hybridization or crossbreeding happened, there was a lot of ice on the landscape. It was during or just before the peak of the most recent ice age. There was a lot of ice that was forming over Ireland, and that was pushing the brown bears that lived there in caves toward the center of the island, toward the edges of that habitat. And at the same time, there was quite a lot of ice forming over the British-Irish Sea, and that was forcing polar bears toward the edges of their habitat. And when they overlapped, they were able to breed.
So the exact reverse is happening now. As the ice melts, the polar bears move further south, and they start to interact with brown bears.
Yes, and in the last 5 years, there have been several instances of hunters finding what they're calling hybrid brown bear and polar bears.
They're calling them a pizzly bear.
Yes.
Which is a stupid name, but they've actually found some of these.
It's a terrible name, and sometimes they're called growler bears as well. I don't think there's been a decision made quite yet about them.
What does this mean for people who are worried about the future of polar bears? Because, of course, this is an endangered species, right?
It doesn't mean much in terms of changing the way that we think about polar bears. I mean, yes, they hybridized in the past, but what's important about that is when they had hybridized, there was still plenty of habitat available for both of these species to go back to. And they could mate with polar bears and become polar bears, or mate with brown bears and maintain those characteristics that are important to being a brown bear. Today, the problem is that they can't return to the ice and act like polar bears because that habitat isn't going to exist anymore. If the only way that polar bears can reproduce is by hybridizing with brown bears, then we're not going to have any more polar bears.
That's evolutionary biologist Beth Shapiro. Her study on the ancestry of polar bears is out this month in the journal Current Biology. Beth Shapiro, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Edwards, Colorado is nested in the Vail Valley, surrounded by the Rockies, a perfect place for high country adventure. Edwards in summer is a great place for hiking or fly fishing on the Eagle River. And if it weren't for the upscale bistros on Main Street, you could almost convince yourself that you'd found the frontier. Nicole Magistro owns Bookworm, a bookstore on Edwards Main Street. She joins us from her home to help us out with our series on vacation reading around the country. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Linda.
Could you just tell us a little bit about Edwards? Who comes in the summer? I guess you must get a different kind of visitor from the ski season. Do they read different things?
They do read different things, and the visitor is very different. We do get a lot of people flocking from big cities like Dallas, New York, Chicago, San Francisco for refuge in the mountains during the summer. We have wonderful restaurants, wonderful cultural activities, and great books to read, too.
So what sorts of books are selling for you now?
Well, during the summer months, we have a tremendous upsurge in all of our regional hiking and guidebooks. So our number one bestseller all summer long is The Vail Hiker. It's a small little guidebook that tells you where to go, what you'll see while you're there, and how difficult it will be to hike up those mountains. Of course, we do sell the bestsellers from the New York Times and the independent booksellers list, but we also sell lots of our favorite summer reads that may not find their way onto those big blockbuster lists.
Surprises? Anything has surprised you this season?
Well, two of our favorites right now are The Invisible Bridge by Julie Oehringer. It's a wonderful World War II story about two Hungarian brothers who go to Paris in the 1930s. And Julie will be visiting Colorado in the fall. And this is one of our favorite staff picks of the year. Another one that people are just loving right now is The Russian Winter, which is by Daphne Kolodi. And it's the story of a prima ballerina set in Russia and in New York, going back and forth. And it's a wonderful summer read because there's romance, there's history, there's intrigue, and it just wraps you right up. You don't want to stop reading it until you've found out what's going to happen at the end.
Well, the way I feel right now in our Washington heat wave, anything that has winter in the title would appeal to me.
Absolutely.
So I gather, since you have the author who's coming in the fall, that you must do this often. You have events at the store to get people in the door?
We do have quite a lot of events in the store, and that creates the buzz in the community for books like The Weird Sisters by Eleanor Brown. Eleanor visited us in late June, and what a wonderful book she has written. Fun summer reading about three girls who come back home as adult women to take care of their parents and also to find themselves, with Shakespeare written all throughout the book. It's fun and witty, but not too academic at all.
Nicole Magistro, what are you reading this summer?
Well, I just finished a wonderful book about Flannery O'Connor, a fictional title called A Good Hard Look by Ann Napolitano. And it's the story that takes place in Midgeville, Georgia, about Flannery's O'Connor's life. And it was just a wonderful summer read, light, historical, but with plenty of fun linked in.
Nicole Magistro is the owner of Bookworm of Edwards, a bookstore in Edwards, Colorado. We called her at her home. Nicole, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. The heat wave gripping much of the country has brought with it unhealthy levels of smog. One of the main components of smog is ozone, and any day now, the Environmental Protection Agency is expected to tighten the standards for how much ozone is safe to breathe. The agency decision is sitting at the White House, waiting for approval. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports that the level of ozone scientists say is safe does not set well with industry.
The EPA is redoing the ozone standards set under President Bush. That's because the Bush administration's EPA ignored the advice of its own panel of outside scientific advisors. It set the standard for a healthy level of ozone in the air at 75 parts per billion. The Obama EPA proposed setting it at between 60 and 70 parts per billion. That's what the scientists recommended. If the agency goes ahead, that will mean many communities around the country would soon be having more orange and red air pollution alert days. New York University professor of environmental medicine, George Thurston, says scientific studies make it clear the air isn't as healthy as the current federal standard suggests it is.
There are areas of the country that thought that their air was safe, but now we can see that there are adverse health effects. Significant adverse health effects, hospital admissions, increased risk of death.
Super hot days like the ones we've been having are prime time for bad air. That's because when hydrocarbons, like puddles of gasoline or oil, evaporate into the air, they help create ozone. The hotter it is, the more they evaporate. The sun's ultraviolet rays cook these vapors and the exhausts from power plants, vehicles, and factories to make smog. When people breathe in ozone, it can irritate and injure their lungs, almost like a sunburn. Thurston says lots of scientific studies, including his own, show that ozone triggers attacks in children with asthma.
Basically, the airways start to close up, and they feel like they're breathing through a tiny straw.
People with other lung ailments and young children are also especially vulnerable. Healthy adults who work or exercise outdoors are at risk, too. When the air is bad, it's best for all of these sensitive groups to go outside in the mornings when ozone levels are lowest.
Really, the air ought to be safe enough for people to be able to go outside anytime. And we shouldn't have to hide inside our homes on the high pollution days. And that's really what setting these standards is all about, trying to make it so that our air is safe to breathe.
But it's not going to be easy for the White House to give the EPA the go-ahead on a tougher standard. Industry groups are heaping on the pressure not to act. The Business Roundtable, a group of CEOs of top companies, sent a letter to the White House warning that strengthening the ozone standard could be the single most expensive regulation ever. But the Clean Air Act directs the EPA to ignore economic costs and make its decision based only on health implications. MIT economist Michael Greenstone was in the White House at the beginning of the Obama administration. He says that isn't easy to do, especially when the economy is weak.
In practice, I think it's very difficult for any administration to be completely blind to economic costs.
And Greenstone says the White House shouldn't ignore economics. For example, tougher standards could require companies to install expensive pollution controls. Then they'd have to charge customers more for electricity and some products.
When families have less money available, that takes a toll on the kinds of foods they can purchase, the kinds of medicine, the kind of health care they can seek. And in its own way, those costs are a very important feature of public health, just as cleaner air is.
So far, neither the White House nor the EPA is showing its cards. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
This is the 100th anniversary of the discovery of Machu Picchu, the cloud city high in the Peruvian Andes, one of the most remarkable archaeological sites on the planet, certainly the most incredible site in the New World. Now, of course, in Peru, they say it was not discovered a century ago today because Peruvians had never lost it. But we in the U.S. give credit to Hiram Bingham III, a remarkable and driven man who thought the Andes might be his last opportunity to make a great discovery.
This was sort of the golden age of exploration. You know, at the moment Bingham got to Peru in 1911, Scott and Amundsen were camped out in Antarctica getting ready to race for the pole. So he was going to make himself famous one way or another. When Who's Who came out, the 1910-1911 edition, even though Bingham was a lecturer in history at Yale, he identified himself as an explorer, and he continued to do so for the rest of his life, even though he later became the governor of Connecticut and then senator from Connecticut.
That's writer Mark Adams talking about Bingham. Adams has written a book called Turn Right at Machu Picchu, Rediscovering the Lost City One Step at a Time. He joined us to talk about Hiram Bingham's journey and his own.
My brilliant, in quotes, idea was to retrace Bingham's route of his expedition in 1911. And that was a journey on which he wasn't actually looking for Machu Picchu. He was looking for another city called Vilcabamba. And while making this sort of circuitous route, he found Machu Picchu and two other almost equally impressive Inca sites.
You had a guide, a wild man from Australia named John Leavers.
Yes, John Leavers. He's a throwback to the sort of pre-Lonely Planet era of travel. You know, when he's not leading trips in the Cusco area, he's off exploring for pre-Columbian ruins that no one has ever recorded before.
Could you read to us from page 92 and give us a little bit of the backstory? Because you're not looking at Machu Picchu yet.
No, no. John and I are walking over one 5,000-foot-high mountain ridge after the other, and we're actually on a 4-day journey on which we didn't see any other trekkers at all.
Now, you're at tremendous altitude.
Yeah, we're approaching 15,000 feet.
Okay, so then what he wanted to show you was what is called the Inca Trail.
Exactly. This is an old part of the Inca Trail, what was known as the Capañán. This may be the finest stretch of original Inca Trail left in all Peru, John said as we crossed a small rise, looking down onto a path that snaked ahead of us like a miniature Great Wall of China. The road was beautifully engineered. The surface was elevated and paved with white stones. Masoned retaining walls on both sides protected the causeway from flooding. In the few spots where the trail had worn through, the deep and intricate foundation work laid down 5 centuries ago was evident. We were walking on a work of art.
How did you get yourself into some kind of shape where you could walk up 5,000 feet just to take a look at a view?
Well, I thought I was in good enough shape when I arrived. But once we got on the trail, John sort of disabused me of that idea. He would say things to me like, you know, Mark, your body's going to adapt through trauma. And when your body and mind are traumatized, that's when you'll adapt.
And you were actually able to do this without dying.
Without dying, although I did have the mother's little helper of the Andes, which is coca leaf.
Now, it's called coca, but it's not cocaine.
No, no, no. It is the root ingredient of cocaine. It keeps your energy levels sort of steady while you're at altitude, and it relieves what they call soroche, or altitude sickness, which is this horrible headache that comes on at high altitude.
Now, when you were reading, you read about the extraordinary structure of the Inca Trail. And I must say, I thought that one of the most interesting things that you talk about in this book is the way the Inca built those extraordinary structures.
Absolutely. The capital of Peru, Lima, the city of Cusco, they've both been leveled several times by earthquakes. But Machu Picchu, when Hiram Bingham got there 100 years ago, was still standing. And the reason for this was that the Incas used this incredible building technique where they would use hammer stones, which are these incredibly hard, small stones that they would bounce off of large pieces of granite, almost like they were playing jacks. And they would flake off little chips until they had the stones in the exact shape that they wanted, and then fit them together as tightly as Legos. And this sort of, without any mortar in them, allows them, they call it dancing. So if there's an earthquake, the buildings can dance. And Machu Picchu itself was built across 2 fault lines. So, you know, it's an area of a lot of seismic activity.
Hiram Bingham's last expedition to Peru was intended to answer the great question of that place. Where do you end up on the question of what Machu Picchu is and what it's for?
I came to the realization that it's a country estate, sure, that's great. But there's another theory that makes even more sense to me, which is that it was a sacred center. And if you stand in Machu Picchu, there are sacred mountains exactly to the north, south, east, and west. There's a sacred river that wraps around the peak, almost encircles it like a python. And Machu Picchu sits at the point where the Andes hit the Amazon basin. So geologically and topographically, this is a really important piece of land. And I think the Incas built this as a truly sacred site. And one day a year, on June 21st, you can actually see the sunrise over a mountain to the east of Machu Picchu. And when it gets above the peak, it shoots a beam of light through a window in the sun temple at Machu Picchu, which is the most beautiful building there. And it forms this sort of rectangular shape on this slab of granite that almost looks like the base of a trophy where the trophy has been cracked off. But that cracked off spot, that sort of missing chunk, that's what we don't know. What was there? I'd love to know what was there.
Mark Adams' book is called Turn Right at Machu Picchu. Mark Adams, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Read about Mark Adams' first meeting with his guide, John Leavers, in an excerpt from Turn Right at Machu Picchu. It's on our website, nbr.org.